from Russia with love I fly to you.
From Russia with love
I fly to you.
Hello and welcome to the James Bond Complex, the show where we discuss, enjoy, and relish in the James Bond phenomenon from Fleming to film and everything in between.
Ooh.
I'm your host, Emery.
I'm the other one of the two hosts this evening. My name is Edgar.
And tonight, because it's the 60th anniversary of From Russia with Love, we're going to do a little bit of a Reloaded episode.
It is a Reloaded episode, and this one is a long time coming. This is sort of the crown jewel of all the potential episodes we could do. Not to belittle our other work, but, you know, when we're talking about From Russia with Love, it's quite special. It's sort of was even more successful than Dr. No. The budget is bigger. The locations are more varied. The action is bigger. It's more eclectic as well. So I think we have a lot to talk about. Is this is not your first Reloaded. I think you were on a Die Another Day Reloaded. Were you not?
I did it, yeah. We did the Die Another Day Reloaded. Or did I?
I wasn't on that one. I remember, I think I was too busy with school.
No, I was, I think I did that with, I think I was on that one. I know it's not my first. I think I've done maybe another one. But anyway, this is the first classic Connery one that we'll do. And this is, it's fitting that it's the 60th anniversary of the, it's really cool that we get the 60th anniversary of the series as a whole in 2022. And then 2023, we get another 60th anniversary, 2024 and 2025 as well. So it's back to back 60th anniversaries of basically the foundation of the franchise.
That is true. And these first four films, some people are inclined to include the fifth one, You Only Live Twice, but certainly the Fab Four from 62 to 65, I think you took the words right out of my mouth. They really do set a standard. You know, Dr. O is the detective investigative story. Goldfinger is your sort of happy-go-lucky. It's a fun jaunt. The gadgets are crazy. The hench person is crazy. The leading lady is quite something.
And it's the first globe-trotting adventure too, Goldfinger, because it's the first one that really goes like, and it includes, you know, the Americas, Europe, and he's going everywhere.
Precisely. From Russia with Love, directed by
From Russia with Love,
I fly to you. I'm a Terrence Young kind of a Bond fan. He's my favorite director, in large part because of the film we're discussing tonight. Now, I've already done an original review of the movie with Matthew, so I'll try not to touch on the same things me and Matt talked about.
Right.
But since you've never been on the show, you've been on the show to talk about... No, you have not done the book with us. I think Melanie did the book with us. But since you've never been on the show to talk about the film, could I ask you to get the ball rolling with your personal history with this movie? If you can relate to the best of your abilities, when did you see it the first time? Has your opinion changed over the decades?
My opinion hasn't changed. I haven't seen it. I hadn't seen it for a while. I rewatched it the other night to get in the mood for the episode, but I hadn't seen it in a while. But it is my favorite poster. I've got a water bottle that Valerie had made for me right before the bourbon. That's the Photoshop my face on the cover, because I think we used that cover. I Photoshopped my face onto the cover for an episode that you guys did on my old podcast. So she took that image and put it on a water bottle that I still have. So it's my favorite poster. I think it's the movie that does the book some of the most justice. There's some little changes that they made to it. And I mean, we'll obviously get into that because it switches the bad guys from Smirsch to Spectre, which, I mean, not much consequence on the movie, but sets up things for later on. But it's so true to the books. It's very Fleming. My wife hates it, but it's still.
Let's do a little 20 seconds. That's what she said. So you watched this with the missus, 00 wife, a few days ago at the time of this recording. How did that experience go for 00 wife?
You know what? So most of the time she'll have a lot of comments through a movie. This one, her main comment was, I can't believe they let Sean Connery on screen like that. And she was the scene where he's like, no comment about the fact that he's been wearing a toupee through every single one of these movies. It's mm-hmm. more the fact he's wearing the little short shorts and his legs are as hairy as a gorilla. Like that's what her main issue was that. I mean, of course, you know, when he slaps the woman around, it bothers her a little bit, but in general, like there's the same little things come up from the Connery era, from other other That's What She Said episodes that make her uncomfortable. She'll never watch it again. She'll never watch Dr. No with me again. Those are out of the question. So she's 0-3 for Connery's. Maybe we'll win her back with Goldfinger. I think the man talk comment might be, you know, in the beginning of the movie might rub her the wrong way, but in general, maybe
Bond's blade of lust turning a woman who swings one way to suddenly swing the other way. I don't know if that's going to go down too well.
So I know 0-3 with the Connerys. She said it was the worst movie she ever saw. But I mean, at the same time, she's not necessarily a fan either of older movies in general. I mean, she's an 80s and 90s girl, and like, I mean, I'm an 80s and 90s guy, but I had an appreciation for the older stuff, less so for her. All good on my side. It doesn't bother me. It just can't make a whole episode out of what she had to say.
So if I'm understanding this correctly, and by all means, I insist that you correct me if I'm wrong in my assessment, you don't mind Sean Connery's hairy legs like a gorilla.
I mean, for me, it comes with Sean Connery. I mean, he's
yes.
it's Pierce Brosnan and Sean Connery, I think, have the same kind of, you know, physique in terms of hair. I think Sean Connery's got the better body out of the two, just to be honest. Like he was a bodybuilder.
Yeah.
Maybe he looks a little better, but I mean, in terms of hairy men, you get what you pay for, you know. It's what it is. What it is. That's what it was in 1963. I think that's we got to keep in mind. It's 1963. It's not 2006. You know, he's not coming out of the water, you know, hairless and gleaming in the sun. He's relaxing by the pool with relaxing by the river with a bottle of champagne tied to his toe. You know, it's not the same vibe.
in England, blonde ones have beautiful bare skin. Interesting. Well, look, I'm sorry to hear that she disliked the film with such fervor, if I may say so. But hey, you can't, as you said yourself a moment ago, you can't win them all. Such as like, but we thank 00Wife for you know, she didn't like Dr. No or Diamonds Are Forever, so kudos to chapeau for her to at least give yet another Connery a try, even though it's a strikeout at this point.
Yeah, but she's a big appreciation. She has a big appreciation for the Brosnans and the Craigs. So, I mean, there's that. Maybe we can ease into the Connerys, not the Connerys, the Roger Moores. Lazenby might be a tough sell, but anyway, take everything that I said there with a grain of salt. She exaggerates all of her comments, of course, for great comedic effect. So don't take that too seriously. I mean,
there have been enough That's What She Said episodes. I think listeners get the point at this stage. I think they know what to expect sometimes.
Oh, she's had some great comments.
yeah.
But getting into the actual movie, I mean, it does set up a lot of the basis for what Fleming brought to the table in terms of the book. There's a lot of Fleming elements that I enjoy from this movie, and a lot of historical Fleming elements. The whole stealing of the Lecter decoder is a direct reference to what he was doing with the OSS and with the BSC back in World War II, trying to steal the Enigma. That's what their goal was in intelligence, was to steal the Enigma to be able to decode messages. So For Musha With Love is kind of a direct parody or a direct copy of that story, you know?
I remember we've had some off-mic conversations, maybe in the chat room some time ago, but it was sort of to that effect where you were vouching for the script's, let's call it, relative authenticity, insofar as back in the day, the Cold War specifically, or World War II, since we're talking about Fleming's personal experience, such missions that sound a little bit crazy at first, you know, just what is it, mincemeat, where they're going to leave a body? You know, that's completely crazy, but they actually gave it a go.
But they actually did it. And it's Fleming's ideas to do these crazy things.
Bless his heart. So you mentioned the book. Would you say this is the, because there are, I think there are a few candidates. Would you say this is the most faithful cinematic adaptation of a Fleming novel?
I'd have to say it's between this one and Goldfinger, because Goldfinger, I think the only real modification they did was the end at Fort Knox was the only real big thing that they changed, because everything else in the book is mostly the same. There's some I'm reading Goldfinger at the moment. I mean, there's some key things that they couldn't produce into film. Like,
yeah, I think I know what you're talking about.
So there's some little things, but I mean, the golf scene, the whole, chronologically, Goldfinger, the movie and the book are exactly the same. The events in the book happen the same way as they happened in the film. From Russia with Love takes a little bit of liberties with the pre-title sequence is different, and there's things that are out of order. They add a few characters that weren't in the book necessarily, and the fact that they changed the bad guy from Spectre from Smersh to Spectre, mm-hmm, right. But still keeping the reference that Rosa Klebb is working for Smersh, which,
yes.
So they made some modifications just to kind of appease the Spectre idea, because I think that's what Fleming really wanted to go with.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, I think that it's a toss up between From Russia with Love and Goldfinger, honestly, to be the most accurate.
Interesting candidates. For me, it's probably a toss up between From Russia with Love and Majesties, although there are a couple key character differences. Tracy's backstory is a little bit more depressing in the book.
It's true that Majesties is actually really, really faithful to the novel. There's a few things that they add on, but it's I would say top three would be or the only three really that I would consider. Doctor No's not too bad either. I mean they do keep it quite tight to the book.
What are some of the translations from book to film that you particularly enjoyed? Are there any highlights where you say, oh, thank goodness, you know, I'm particularly happy this made it into the film?
Red Grant getting the massage was one. I think that was kind of like, you read it in the book and it's like you get that visual and you see it in your head. Then you see it on screen and it's like, oh yeah, that's exactly right from the book. And I would say that, and if I'm remembering correctly, the Russian coming out of the mouth of the billboard is in the book as well.
It is.
So some of those elements, like, I mean, they take some liberties with some things, but that and the train fight, I mean, the whole Orient Express, very Fleming, and I'm glad that made it into film.
Yeah, that is good. I do like the little change they do just before the fight commences, insofar as in the book, it's his cigarette case that protects his heart from the shot, whereas in the film, it's actually mental trickery, where he opens one of the cases, he says, oh, there's probably more gold sovereigns than the other one, and since Greg Grant doesn't know how to open an MI6-equipped case, that's where the powder explodes. I do like that little change. Speaking of changes, are there any changes from the book to screen that you particularly are pleased with, or maybe not?
Well, I mean, they do establish the first meeting with Q. The real first real Q meeting, and the real first gadget that's not in the book, but they made it in the movie, but it's close enough to stuff that they would have had at the time. Like, it's still Fleming enough, and it's still intrepid enough. Like, I'll reference intrepid because they were doing, they had a whole departments designated for that, and it's they were that spycraft. Like, there's a lot of those little spycraft elements. And I really do like the kind of the folding rifle. They call it a folding rifle, but it's not really a folding rifle. It's a travel rifle or a survival rifle. And I think all of that kind of stuff was cool. I think that's a nice addition. And the boat chase is a nice addition.
That's true. What is it you just said about the rifles? I didn't quite understand that part.
The rifle is a survival rifle. So it's designed for everything. They're real rifles. They still make them today. The AR-7. I don't remember the company that makes them now. It's not the same one as back then, but everything fits inside the butt of the rifle. So that was kind of like a cool gadgety thing. Totally impractical. He wouldn't have been able to do what he did with that because it's a very small caliber. And I'm sure that Ray from Bond's Armory will back me up. Mm. shooting down the helicopter. That and the end of Spectre when he's shooting at it with his pistol with the PPK shooting at the helicopter. It's like obviously he's not able to hit that. I mean, it's a great shot, but I mean it's a long shot. It's a long shot. At least he's got a rifle this time. It's different, but
in this film's defense, not Spectre's defense. I don't know anything about guns, and I thought that was pretty silly. But in From Russia with Love, he doesn't hit the copter itself. He hits the Spectre agent holding the grenade, and then the grenade explodes. So they sort of get away with it.
But that's a nice addition. I mean, what would you think? What were the additions or the differences between the book and the film that the omissions or additions that the adaptation
omissions and additions. I particularly enjoy the fact that Spectre are the villains in this instance, which I guess I'm going to contradict myself, because I remember in the lead up to Bond 25, before it was called No Time to Die, I remember one of my, not to say qualms, but say ambitions for the future movie was, not enough people really cared for Spectre, so how about we just send Daniel off on a banger, and it's a one-off. I don't need sequels, which is a sentiment I still hold to a degree. I'm going to contradict myself. I kind of think it's cool that From Russia with Love is a sequel to Dr. No. And Kronstein says that it's an opportunity for us to gain revenge on our operative Dr. No. I do like that. I think it's very smart on the part of the producers, the filmmakers, to not get too political and to reference the Russians, reference Smersh, who is a Klebs former employee. But I think that's very smart. As for what they kept in, I particularly like, and I'd like to get your thoughts on this too, maybe segue into another topic here. I like how they handle Tatiana's arc. She is a Russian cipher clerk. She works with the Lector every afternoon from 2 to 3 or 3 to 4, I can't remember.
Yeah, 2 to 3.
And her mission, as ordained by Rosa Klebb, is to, quote, fall in love, end quote, with Bond. Now, about an hour later, when we're in the Orient Express and Kerem Bey has unfortunately departed this world, Connery gives her a good whooping and says, like, stop lying, what's going on? And that I always find that scene very interesting, which is, I love you, Dushka, I love you. I like how they handle it, because it's, I find it sufficiently vague. Like, when does she really fall in love with James Bond?
Right.
What do you think about that? It's hard to say, I find. But
It's hard to say exactly the moment. Because, I mean, in the book, I think it's a little more clear, because they have a little more – there's a little more intimacy in the book about the relationship. And it's almost – cold. I think it was maybe what was missing is maybe a scene with her alone admiring his photo. Maybe could have helped her story arc a little bit better. Or
instead, they decided to have her look in her little mirror and pretend her hair is a mustache.
Yeah,
missed opportunity.
But I think it plays well for the fact that it kind of establishes her as naive.
Mm-hmm.
I think that helped in that sense, but at the same time, like the establishment of the romantic relationship, I think it just kind of keeps it cold. But that was kind of what they did in those movies too. Like, there was never that was kind of the escapism of it, was she would just fall in love with him and it was just like that. There was no it wasn't like Madeline falling in love with him slowly and progressively. It was bang, it just happens. And then there's a little bit of questioning and everything. I think the only big difference between her story arc in the book and in the novel is she doesn't get as molested by Rosa Klebb as she does in the book. I mean, the sexual tension in the book is really awkward. And knowing that Fleming is writing this, and he's getting super creative with the creepiness of it all. I'm kind of glad they did it at the same time, because, I mean, it is already awkward, that scene. Especially since, and this is actually one of the other points that Valerie mentions, and this is something that we also mentioned on the Monty Norman episode that we did not too long ago, is the lack of orchestration in key scenes. There's some scenes that lack kind of like that mood-setting music, where there's like no sound, and you can hear that like faint echo. Like you could hear the walls. which it's the time that was made, that was what they had, and that's how they did it, because they didn't have better sound editing. But the lack of orchestration in those moments, some of the other fight scenes are a little awkward, and some of the action scenes are awkward because the orchestration isn't as nice as it would have been under the tutelage of Hans Zimmer or David Arnold or et cetera. So I think that's for her story arc, for some portions of it, there's stuff that's kind of missing there that, that would have maybe enhanced how her story arc would have progressed.
Possibly. First of all, I just want to point out, I'm very proud of you, Emery. You actually said that, you know, understanding that John Barry worked on this film score, that you're saying it doesn't have the same orchestration as if Hans Zimmer had worked on it. I'm very, very proud of you. I'm a Zimmer head, very much a Zimmer head.
But
I'm
in the sense disciple. That in the 60s, it wasn't, that wasn't the thing. Like, it wasn't a thing yet until the late 70s, mid 70s, where, you know, you got your Star Wars with great orchestration and key scenes being, and like orchestration throughout. Whereas this was, there's a few scenes where they have pieces of music that are nice and that are fitting, but there's a lot of the sound editing is still catching up to the times.
It sounds a little mono at times.
Yeah.
Not stereo.
Yeah.
That's also part and partial with, I guess, with the equipment they were using back in the day. Since we're talking about John Barry and did not too long ago, maybe we'll just spend a couple minutes on that. Are there any particular cues? Because I know this a bit like Dr. No, the soundtrack is not quite always what we hear in the movie, but at least as far as what's in the movie, are there any particular cues that you like? Any scenes?
Well, I mean, we get two theme songs, and we get, you know, the actual song from Russia with Love song. We get it at 2 points in the movie. And in fitting areas of the movie where it makes sense to have it there. And it's playing on the radio at one point, and it's playing, it's near the end titles, I think, when they're in Italy.
Plays over the end credits. Yeah.
But we've got a pre-title sequence. We've got the theme song, theme song. Doesn't matter that it wasn't the sung theme song. We got a theme song that was for that movie. It wasn't reused again. It was for that movie. And then back to the action. It was just that the Bond theme showed up at places where I don't think it belonged. But it's still John Barry. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's this beautiful version of it. Blows Monty Norman out of the water. But I mean, it's in the wrong places sometimes, I find, you know?
I mean, I can think further to your point, I can think of when he's investigating his hotel room for bugs in it. I believe it's the Dr. No James Bond theme. That's a little bit.
It's out of place there. There could have been a better piece there, but at least we got something. Like, it could have just been mono, just him fuddling around and, you know, no Foley artist and whatever sound was available. So it, you know, the sound editing, I think Matt had made a comment about the sound editing in Dr. No. You know, they found for this machine, they made a sound for this, and they with a composite of this. It doesn't feel like they do any of that work on these movies, you know?
Possibly. I know one of my favorite cues happens at the San Sofia Monastery, the one with the bells and is it strings or horns or air, the winds, I think. I believe it's winds and bells. And there's a great echoey. I wonder how they recorded that, actually. I think that's a beautiful piece of music and very befitting of that scene, because it's a very hollow area. It's very wide. It's very echoey. That's probably one of my favorite cues, and the music that plays over the title sequence. I mean,
it's a great piece of music, and it's very Bond. Like, that's kind of where the John Barry kind of sets the precedent of what's Bond music. And I think the movie kind of like the Bond, whole Bond stereotype. There's so many things that are derived from Blofeld. I mean, when Blofeld becomes the model, the cat, the hidden figure part of it. I mean, it's Anthony Dawson who's recycled from Dr. No, but it's someone else's voice, but it's also Dr. Claw, Inspector Gadget. It's also, what's his name in Austin Powers? The
Dr. Evil?
Dr. Evil. Forgetting his name. It's the basis of what becomes Dr. Evil. Everything kind of starts with... Those kind of easily parodied things that happen later, the henchmen, the big villain, the secret lair, the, you know, all that,
including the chief villain happily destroying his own minions. Like he kills Kronstein at the end there, where you think Rosa Klebb is going to get it. And it's like, well, it's not Kronstein's fault. The plan was pretty good, actually. You don't have to kill him. You may need him in a few weeks from now, but there are a lot of templates here. We talked about Q, we talked about the gadget, we talked about the music. I guess the only template we don't have yet that'll be in a movie from now, but is the Bond car, like the Bond car of the film.
Because he's got a Bentley in for Russia with Love, but we see it from behind, and the only real gadget is the phone. Yeah. I mean, great gadget for 1963, but I mean, who's got a car phone now? Everyone doesn't. I mean, it's very 90s. It's very late 80s, 90s drug dealer BMW-ish. It's not. It doesn't scream, you know, secret agent. and there's, I mean, speaking of Anthony Dawson, there's also a lot of recycled actors that get recycled later. Like Anthony Dawson is kind of the first recycled Bond actor, but then we get Martine Beswick, Walter Gotell.
Yeah. As a different, you're right. As a recycled, he's a completely different character.
Which I didn't realize that he was in this movie. That I'm like, I'm watching it. I'm like, I know this guy was in another movie.
Yeah. He's in another movie I've seen. Maybe even a few I've seen. He's so much younger. I mean, this is
5 years later. He was in License to Kill.
Walter Gotell. No, I was thinking about Walter Gotell, who's between From Russia with Love and The Spy Who Loved Me. There's 14 years, so he's a much younger man, and his role is very small in this as well.
Is he not in License to Kill?
Well, the Russians don't make an appearance in License to Kill, so he's at the very end of Living Daylights at the Opera House.
Living Daylights, yes, exactly. Yeah. Okay, that's what I was thinking of, yes.
It's quite incredible to think that that actor, who's not in the movies very much, and he's not even in every film, but his first one's 63 and his last one's 87. That's pretty, it's quite something, actually.
Well, I mean, varied roles, but anyway, it's the kind of the, for me, it was like the start of let's recycle some actors. Because, I mean, Martine Beswick comes back in Thunderball. Two movies later. At least Desmond Llewellyn kind of like he's introduced, but not as Q, but becomes Q. He's the same, but not the same, but the same.
Yeah. Have you heard the story about how that, what Peter Hunt did to that scene in the editing room when they showed it to Terrence Young the first time?
No.
They, Q, or the tech engineer, shows Bond the attaché case and shows how to open it, and it says, now you try. And apparently, you know, it's a gag, but apparently Peter Hunt edited so that there was an explosion on the soundtrack, the movie ended, and the end credits started after that.
That sounds like a Saturday Night Live gag, you know?
It does. That shows up, I think, in the archives and Some Kind of Hero. I think I read it in both of those books. Oh, yeah. But apparently they had a good laugh about that. Speaking of, you know, recycling actors, you know, they recycle voices a lot. You know, a lot of characters in this movie are dubbed. What's your opinion on the dubbing of so many of these characters in these early Connerys and maybe in this movie? Does it bother you? Do you not care? Is it dubbing good enough that it doesn't matter?
Well, I mean, for years I was kind of ignorant to the fact that Goldfinger was dubbed. Like, I don't think I really realized that until I was in my late teens, early 20s, that I realized that he was dubbed. And then I figured out, well, everyone's dubbed by the same people. it doesn't bother me because I'm aware of it. Just because I know that that was what they did at the time, because they couldn't get a better sound quality or... and I think I had mentioned this in the Dr. No episode as well. Or I mentioned it about Dr. No. We were talking about Ursula Andress, her accent being too heavy for, European or North American audiences. So I kind of get why they do it. But at the same time, like, I mean, I think for us here in Quebec, we're kind of used to the fact that if you're watching a movie in French, and it's dubbed from an English, you're going to get the same actors dubbing things all the time, and it's not going to match. So it doesn't bother me as much because it's matched better.
That's true. That's true. The dubbing for Tatiana Romanova is great. Like little bit like you. It took me years to figure out that she was dubbed. I, honest to God, for years I thought that was Daniela Bianchi's.
Yeah, because but you wouldn't be able to tell because it was so like, I mean, you've got to sync it so well. Mm. So it's I guess the sound editor's real job in these movies was syncing up the overdubs. Because I mean, she still had to deliver her lines, but with, you know, it's a really good lip sync. I mean, it's better than the Super Bowl.
Ah, very well played there, sir. Chapeau. My hat's a brilliant coup. It is great. It is very good, and it's so believable because I really do feel like the whole it really does create a full performance. I don't have that nagging issue in the back of my mind that it's not really Tatiana Bianchi, Daniela Bianchi.
Yeah,
it isn't because it's not her voice, but I don't have that idea nagging me in the back of my mind. So they did a really good job on that. Really good job. There's a significant character we haven't talked about yet, and that's a character many fans consider to be the greatest of Bond allies, that being Ali Kerem Bey, played by Pedro Armendariz. Now, my prelude was that many Bond fans consider this to be the greatest Bond ally. I guess two-part question. Do you agree, and why or why not?
I wouldn't say he's the greatest, because I still think that Felix Leiter is the greatest, just because Felix Leiter was there in the books. I'm really like hard on the parallels between Fleming and film.
Mm-hmm.
Just because Felix Leiter plays such an integral part of the early books. Mathis to a certain extent for mm-hmm. Casino Royale, and they kind of like, that's probably my only qualm with how they handled him in Casino and in Quantum mm-hmm. is how they just kind of tossed him aside. But mm-hmm. Felix is that Bond ally for me that is, I think I've said this before, and I think I've said this a couple of Christmas episodes ago when we were doing the kind of the fan casting, what we would want to happen with the series. As I would say, if they had Felix do his own series, like if they were mm-hmm. going to make a TV series out of a character, okay. mm-hmm. it would kind of be Felix's Pinkertons, but like set in the 60s. And I think that because he's the better ally, because they kind of have like that buddy cop vibe. And I mean, Live and Let Die is the ultimate book for that. But Kerem Bey on his own, is he better than, say, Quarrel? Yes. Because mm-hmm. Quarrel was a good ally, but at the same time, the way that he's portrayed and the way he's written, he's more of an assist than he is an ally. Whereas Kerem Bey is the equal, if not a step above Bond in the hierarchy of MI6. And he's far more interesting of a character, and he's far more integral to the film than other allies have been. Like, I mean, Felix mm-hmm. Leiter has been present in other films, but never so much as a presence of an ally has Kerem Bey been. Like, he's been the most present ally.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you just mentioned Kerem Bey is either Bond's equal or even supersedes him. And yeah, I mean, he is head of section, and he's been stationed in Istanbul for such a long time. And there is a very pleasant joie de vivre with that character, which is mm-hmm. sadly ironic for anyone who knows the behind-the-scenes story. The actor was gravely ill. Quite literally deathly ill during the shooting of From Russia With Love. So they did most of his scenes early in the production. But despite that, the actor Pedro Armendariz overcomes that and really makes Kerem Bey a very joyful character.
Mm-hmm.
That's not to say that he's not joyful to an extent in the book, but there is a little bit of would you say there's a little bit of barbarism to that character in the book, you know, with the woman chained beneath the table? You know, it's a little like, ooh, boy, who is this guy? Whereas the movie has none of that. The movie just loves living.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he obviously wasn't too enthused by his woman calling for him. It saved his life, but like she was not having any of that. It was bothering him more than anything. But he's got that kind of his character in the movie, a little bit different than the book. I mean, there's a lot of similarities, but yeah, there's those. But I mean, you couldn't make that into a movie. You couldn't put that into a movie I mean, it's very hard to put that into a book, but Fleming did it anyway because it was Fleming. Yeah. I mean, he wrote Live and Let Die and then just cruised on path and continued doing what he was doing.
But I have no time for these silly questions. I have a third book to write.
You just let's make it to a movie. It doesn't matter. That couldn't get in to film. You couldn't film it like that. Just like you couldn't film Live and Let Die the way it was meant to be filmed as the book, because
you would the language anyways. I mean, you could film it, but you'd literally have to remove bits of language.
There's kind of those. But I mean, like if you pick up any piece of Thrilling Cities is an example of how he just describes any culture with like warts and all. Everything is just the worst part of a culture he will dig up. So, I mean, is there some things that are maybe culturally accurate to an extreme? Possibly, yes. Is it okay that we excluded it from the film? Absolutely, we don't. There's the Goldfinger reference we'll get to eventually is the same thing. It's a cultural reference that doesn't need to be on film.
Right. You know, it's funny. I don't want to backtrack too much, but just very briefly on the strategy of recycling actors. Kieran Bain's girlfriend, do you know where she, what other movie she's in?
Oh, God, isn't she in... isn't she in Majesties? Isn't she one of the... No.
As far as I know. No, the Angels of Death? No, she's not one of the Angels of Death.
No, then I don't know.
She is the little Mexican dancer in the pre-titles of Goldfinger.
Oh, God. The next movie.
Both roles are quite inspiring.
Well, I mean, Martine Beswick gets, you know, she... The gypsy fight, I don't remember that being in the book necessarily.
Well, they do spend some time at the gypsy camp in the book, and there is a rivalry between two women pertaining to something having to do with a man who lives in the mountains. I would need to reread the book again.
Right, yeah.
But let's I'm glad you brought up the gypsy camp because that actually was in one of my notes. To what extent do you think that it slows down the pace a little bit or not? Are you particularly chuffed by the gypsy camp? What's your take on the gypsy camp? This is a bit of an odd one.
It's slightly poorly explained to why they're going.
Okay.
It's kind of just like, oh, we're going here. And they just show up. And it doesn't feel like it moves the story along. I mean, it does because it's... Kirilenko? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Kirilenko.
Who comes along and they get into there's the firefight and he's trying to kill Kieran Bay and Ali Kieran Bay. There's that, that kind of connects it, but it feels kind of like forced. And then, yeah, it does kind of slow things down. And then there's kind of like the forced, I'm going to give you a woman aspect of the Bond film that it's kind of like, I don't know. And of course, you know, double a wife. Just I absolutely appreciated that. Like, he's got to choose one of these bitches. Excuse my language. I'm gonna beep. He's got to choose one of these women, and so that kind of doesn't.
Decide.
That kind of is like contextually speaking. Does it? Yeah. What I don't like in movies is when something happens in a movie or in a TV show that doesn't move the story along. Like, if it doesn't have to be there, if it isn't enriching the story, then there's no point in it being there. Does the gypsy fight move the story along? It's a little bit of a sideshow that happens that kind of entertains the viewers for a few moments. And then they could have just gone from halfway through the gypsy fight right to the attack, firefight, and then move on. But the whole resolution of it and then the pick one and that kind of – I think up from that point on, it slows everything down. Just a little bit before it picks up again. So that is kind of a little bit of a lull in the middle of the movie for...
It is a bit of an interesting one because I think I know there are certain fans, you know, content producers who enjoy that stretch because it does something a bit more of the older, especially the Connery films would do, which is that it would bask a little bit in the culture. Mind you, this is sort of a, not only do we go to Turkey, but we go to Istanbul specifically, and not only in Istanbul, but we're in a gypsy camp on the outskirts. It's like, you know, we're getting really specific here, but we do get to bask a little bit in a culture. But I can't contest very ferociously your point about it it's a little bit clumsy with respect to advancing the plot. I mean, okay, so we get confirmation that Krylenko is the one, or Krylenko's raison d'être in this film is to destroy Kerem Bey, but I mean, they bombed his apartment. We saw Krylenko underneath the cisterns there with the old submarine periscope. So it's not like we don't know A, this character exists, B, Kerem Bey is a rival, and it's a Bond movie, so he's probably a bad, you know, do we need to spend 10 minutes at the gypsy camp? Probably not.
No, it could have been done in 6 or 7. Like, honestly, they could have spared the whole pick one at the end. We could have cut from there and, you know, move the story along a little bit. I think that's kind of where it slows down.
However, I do feel, and I don't want to sidetrack us too much, although maybe just very briefly, we can just touch upon a topic that I'm quite keen on when it comes to filmmaking and what makes the cut in the edit room and what gets left on the cutting room floor is, and I find this is a Terrence Young thing, is he will leave in his movies these little moments that obviously are not scripted. The actors are just reacting to things or doing things. I think Tanya pretending her hair is a mustache is one of them. and I think another one of them is Connery chuckling at the belly dance. I think
I'm glad you mentioned that, because that does awaken a memory. Another that's what she said moment. The comment was, why didn't they get someone better to do the belly dance?
What?
I don't know. It was at one point, it was not necessarily the beginning, but like halfway through, like she starts doing something with the actual belly. It wasn't the hip shaking, it was the actual belly undulating.
These contortions, these very specific contortions at the bottom of her stomach.
She was not impressed.
Really?
The hip shaking, maybe a little bit, but that part, no, she wasn't impressed. Wait, so I could do that. I could do that too.
Wife get these high standards for belly dancing suddenly? I don't understand.
Okay, caveat, these are exaggerated comments, because she knows that this is what's going to get the laughs.
All right.
So she's a little comedian. But anyway, yeah, so if we move along from that, the main, like, henchman villain, or not the main one, but the one that we have, like, the focus on in the beginning, because we had the pre-title sequence we didn't really talk about. The pre-title sequence is the faux killing of Bond by Red Grant. He doesn't talk the entire movie until we get to the Orient Express. Very much like the books. I'm glad that they kept that like that. How do you feel about that whole performance of Red Grant and how they... I mean, we have a good portion of the movie where he's not seen.
Well, he is, you might say he's a bit of a specter throughout the entire film. In the sense, you know, I think it's a story of two performances. It's two performances in one from Robert Shaw. The initial performance is the physical one, the pre-titles, the massage, little moments where he's, I think, one of the most brilliant examples of directing and editing in any Bond movie is when we're on the Orient Express, but Bond and Grant haven't met. And it's a wide shot of Bond. They might be in Zagreb, and Bond is walking outside the train, and Red Grant is following him and staring at him through the windows. But the camera's panning at the same time. That is absolutely, I mean, this is why Terrence Young and is my guy. But so you have the physical performance, and then we get the more vocal performance. So we sort of have two Robert Shaws in this movie. I don't know which one I like more. Certainly his physicality is quite imposing. I think he is one of my favorite henchmen. I think his sneakiness is quite good. We don't have many. I'm sure there's someone that's just not coming to mind now, but in any of the other films, be they Connery's or any of the other five actors, you know, when's the next time we get a hench person who is everywhere, but Bond has no idea?
Well, very rarely. I think it might get all the way to View to a Kill, maybe.
Who would that be in View to a Kill? Like Mayday?
Maybe
not
or
really. I mean, they. I mean, Bond. Or I was about to say Bond bets Mayday. I think it's the other way around. Mayday bets Bond pretty early in that movie. So I'm not sure about that.
I'm trying to think of another henchman who's kind of like that, because I mean, Oddjob is there, but always with Goldfinger. He's never kind of, well, there's that one point where he's driving the car, but I mean, other than that, where he's alone, but there's
Bond
not really.
Bond's aware of his presence. Bond knows aware of his presence. Oddjob exists. Whereas in Fresh and with Love, Bond has no idea that Red Right exists.
I think it might be the only time really where he's kind of being tailed throughout the whole movie without really him being aware. Because I mean, he's not aware at all until he. Of course, it's food related. He orders the wrong wine with his fish, which is really super British. Right. And I find, and I mean, I wouldn't make that mistake either. You don't order red wine with fish. What kind of maniac are you? But it's kind of that little subtlety of like, oh, that's why he's the bad guy. I mean, no, nothing else triggers him. Maybe the old boy stuff, but it's like, oh, he ordered red wine with fish. I don't like this guy.
Yeah, that's a little bit. That's very Fleming. To be fair, that's definitely Fleming. Fleming would be very posh, and prissy about his menus, and therefore Bond would be very posh about them as well. Very specific. I mean, I'm a big fan of Red Grant. It's funny because Robert Shaw wasn't. I don't believe he was taller than Sean Connery. He might have even been an inch or two shorter. But the way those cabin, now we're on the Orient Express, the way those cabin moments are shot, because Connery's on, or Bond is on his knees, looking upwards, and Red Grant, it's very well filmed, in addition to Red Shaw giving a wonderful, wonderful performance. Well, what do you think about the character and the performance?
I think it was really great. I think the Garrote was a nice touch too, as kind of like the implement of death. Mm-hmm. They don't spend any time on his backstory, which is a little bit, but I mean, it's different than the book. The book, we get a whole chapter of his, you know, homicidal midnight killings once a month.
Werewolf.
They let him move. Yeah. But it's very much more Russian training and all that. So they kind of, they skip over that part, but I don't think it hurts the performance and the kind of the presence that he has. Like, he's there. He's, you could tell that, like, when Rosa Klebb first meets him and they call him over and he comes right away and doesn't make a sound, and like she punches him in the gut and he doesn't move, and you know this guy's stone cold killer, like this guy is nuts. And it's so perfect performance in that regard. I think he's maybe missing some of the physical. He's not as physically imposing as I would have wanted him to be. If I was to recast it, then I would go with with a much, you know, more physical presence kind of person.
For all intents and purposes, actually, you know what? I think I just figured it out. I think I just answered my own question. Mr. Hinks.
Yeah, I think it would be. But even Mr. Hinks, like he's there, but he's not aware of him at first, but he's aware of him. He's aware of him the entire time, because when Hinks arrives, that's he true. Arrives at the Spectre meeting, and then they that's kind true. Of cross paths yeah, a few times. Yeah, they've crossed paths that. Three times, so
spoke too soon. But as far as casting, you know,
that would be
if Bautista had been in his 30s or 40s, that's who he would have cast as Red Grant, essentially.
Yeah, because I mean, you need someone who would be. I think he might even, Dave Bautista was probably a little bit too muscular, just because like he's got to look good in a suit. Like he's got to have the right, the kind of like the cut where he looks good in a suit and he doesn't look like he's bursting out, but imposing enough where he's got the stance and the more like a well-dressed football player, but still physically tall. Right.
Well, I think that's one of those things where, you know, I try to be a little bit mindful when I'm watching a movie, especially a movie that's 60 years old at this point. You know, the physicality expected of actors wasn't quite the same as it is today. Now, that's not to say that Sean Connery and Robert Shaw circa 63 were not in shape. They most certainly were. But within the context of what was expected of actors who were going to partake in a particularly physical role, a physically demanding role, you do get the sense that that's pretty much as good as it got back in the early 60s, which is something. They're fit, like, make no mistake about it. They're fit. They're two fit men.
But we made the immediate parallel to Dave Bautista and Daniel Craig, because I mean, Daniel Craig is our model for Bond presently, because he's been our Bond for 14 years now, forever. And the immediate, like, who's physically more imposing? Well, in the last five movies, the only one who's really been physically more imposing than Bond has been Hinks. So that's kind of like the parallel you draw right away. Back then, you didn't have these kind of movies. Like, these were the first of their kind, so you went with what you had. But if I think that Fleming wrote it in so that the person would be physically... But they didn't have the resources to do that actor didn't exist.
No, Dave Bautista. I don't know if he was born or someone of that ilk, cut from that cloth. We've started talking a little bit about Red Grant and that character's physicality. There's obviously a legendary fight that happens in that cabin. Mm-hmm. And after that fight, we can talk about the fight itself, but after that fight, then there is the helicopter chase sequence. Mm-hmm. And after the helicopter chase sequence, there's the boat chase. Mm-hmm. Do you think the film is a little bit too backloaded with action? Would you have rather it been parsed out throughout the runtime? What's your feeling on the action in From Russia with Love?
Yeah, you have a point there. It is kind of backloaded there, where they've got the one chase scene after another. I mean, they all work. But your climax is overloaded. Like, you've got a really heavy climax. And the train scene can start to get a little bit long because, you know, they stop in Zagreb and then they stop later on and they stop again and they get off. And if they could have shortened all that, but then they would have had to try and fit an action scene somewhere where maybe along the lines of the book it didn't belong. Mm-hmm. I mean, you would have had to have almost a chase scene before getting to the train is the only real place in the movie that I could foresee them having and they kind of did have an action moment right before then. So I guess they could have just extended that into a car chase, I suppose.
Like the escape from the embassy after it blows up sort of a type.
Yeah, they get to like right from the embassy right onto the train. So, I mean, if they had added if it had been a modern Bond movie, I mean, that's when he would have gotten into the Aston Martin and then there would have been a car chase to the train and then the train would have kind of calmed down and we would have had, the end fight and they probably would have, continued off on the train and that would have been a movie. But that's, I mean, we got three good action sequences out of it and it's kind of set the precedent for future films.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to somehow, some way, be in 1963 just for a couple of hours and not being aware of the James Bond film franchise and seeing this movie and basically the last half hour is just a bunch of fisticuffs and vehicular warfare, essentially. And then an old lady dying and getting shot and perishing. It's quite a tempo during those final 20 minutes.
In the ugliest hotel room I've ever seen. Like those walls were...
I would have expected more from Venice. I was expecting more. A little disappointed.
1963, it kind of went with the wallpaper. It was a look.
It's interesting that Rosa Klebb gets in on the action herself. I know it's from the book, and the book ends in a starkly different way than the film does. But it's interesting that Rosa Klebb gets in on the action, because it always feels like whenever we're on that Spectre boat with the unseen Blofeld that... Well, obviously, Blofeld is not going to get his hands dirty, well, at least not in this movie. Kronstein's not going to get his hands dirty. I never get the impression that Rosa Klebb is going to get her hands dirty. But I suppose after the entire plan fails, one that she signed off on, I guess it's her way of trying to make it up to Blofeld, that she's, I'll do it myself type of a thing.
It's her redemption, She doesn't want to lose her job, and she's trying to get back into, the good graces of Fearless Leader. There's another parallel there. As Fearless Leader is with Rocky and Bullwinkle.
That's true.
With the Russians, I think it kind of like rounds out the her story arc too, and kind of sets up the future of how Spectre operates. I don't really think we get really too much. We get the kind of a taste for Spectre in this movie. I think we really get it in Thunderball. That's kind of bang. It's there. And I think out of all the Spectre movies where they're present, Thunderball does become one of the better ones, just because there's more of a sense of the of how the operation runs and the mystique of it, and it kind of comes to a head. I mean, we see him eventually, and you only live twice, it kind of leaves you wanting, whereas From Russia With Love is the first real taste. Like, oh, well, what's going on here? And then it's mostly absent in Goldfinger, but then Thunderball, it's like, ooh, them again.
Yeah, well, I guess it's a product of the fact that the From Russia With Love, the book, doesn't have Spectre. It's Smirsch. Yeah. I believe it's the last one where Smirsch is a significant villain. And Thunderball, you know, Kevin McClory, Fleming debate aside, Thunderball, the book, really is a Spectre adventure. We have the board meeting. We have Blofeld's backstory. So when they translated Thunderball, it makes sense that that's because they already had a template as to how to present Spectre.
It was already supposed to be a movie. Thunderball was a movie.
That's true.
They said they all got too drunk and they didn't finish it. And they decided, well, I'm going to make it into a book. Screw you guys. Basically. And then they said, well, we're going to make it into a movie. And I'm actually surprised that Kevin McClory kind of didn't like clue into the whole Spectre thing until Thunderball. Like, I mean, he obviously sees From Russia With Love and sees that Spectre's being used in From Russia With Love. When does he push the button and say, hey, that's my guys. I made those.
Well, you know, they made those films as I believe we got the ball rolling on this recording with that commentary that the first four films were done in such a rapid succession that to you and I, it might feel as though Kevin McClory was slow on the dial to contest the usage of Spectre. But in reality, they pooped out these films so freaking quickly.
I suppose. I think I guess it was when he saw the success of Dr. No and he said, oh, wait a minute. I'm missing in on this cash cow. And I mean, he finally got paid in Thunderball, or so we would hoped, but he kept on stabbing at it until...
Yeah, unfortunately, that's for another episode, but yeah, it's a little bit... it's unfortunate because that whole saga begins with someone where even I'm a little bit like, well, yeah, if he did work on that original idea, he probably should get paid a little bit. And then fast forward 20-odd years later, it's like, oh, this guy again. Like, you hate this person all of a sudden.
Yeah.
It's like, but I mean, it's like, it made sense.
Thunderball, the book, came out in 58, 59.
Something like
and
that.
So the movie wasn't successful until 3 years after that. So all these meetings that they had, I mean, the money didn't come in until much, much later because he didn't make that much profit off the book, obviously. He made the money off his films.
Yeah.
And even then... Like, how much was Fleming pocketing from that? He already sold the rights.
Yeah, so that's true. I don't know if there was any back-end deal or anything like that. Like, gross first... I don't think there was such a thing as first gross return or anything. I don't know. Maybe there was. I don't know if that existed back then. Where if you're involved in a film, you get... just, you know, if a $20 movie ticket is sold before any of that money has gone to any of the backers, you get like 10%. Like, that'd be insane.
Pretty sure that wasn't it because they were scrounging for cash just to get the first one made.
That's true.
I think they're paying Universal back first for the generous loan that they got for Dr. No. And then they said, oh, wait a minute. There's money to be had here.
What do you think about Sir Sean Connery, our dearly departed? Like, everybody, I shouldn't say everybody, that's patently false. Many Bond fans believe him to be the best James Bond. If I'm not mistaken, he's your favorite James Bond?
He is my favorite James Bond. And that's for me, it's the model of James Bond starts with Connery.
And is his performance, is his Bond in From Russia With Love better than the other? Where do you stand on Connery's Bond in this film vis-a-vis his five other ones?
This one would probably be number two.
Number two, interesting.
Because Goldfinger for me would be number one.
Interesting, very interesting.
I've got the long connection with Goldfinger, but I think his performance overall in Goldfinger is the joke delivery is better. I mean, I think his lines are written a little better too for Goldfinger. But I mean, his performance in From Russia With Love is stellar. So that's why I would put it at number two.
Interesting, nice.
Dr. No is decent enough, and You Only Live Twice as well. I mean, not that Diamonds is a bad performance of Sean Connery. I think that the movie itself kind of dilutes his performance of it. But for me, yeah, top two would be Goldfinger then From Russia With Love in terms of his performance and, you know, mm-hmm. delivery of his lines and the convincingness of his character and all that.
Yeah. Yeah, he does feel like a great James Bond in this. It helps. I find it helps that it is such a faithful adaptation of Fleming's mm-hmm. story. And it was a story so thickly entrenched in the Cold War.
Yeah.
And even though the villains have been switched over to Spectre, officially speaking, the Cold War is lurking in the background. Spectre is essentially taking advantage of Cold War tensions.
Oh, yeah. And you're in Cold War territory, and it's Cold War villains, even if they're Spectre, they're Russian. So, and they're mm-hmm. Russians in Turkey. So
I think it works for this universe, and it works for this interpretation of Bond, where he's, I find him to be particularly relaxed in this film. Not to say that he isn't in Dr. No, but I think he's just a little bit more comfortable this time around. I think his rapport with Armendariz is excellent. Mm-hmm. I think he's quite good with Daniela Bianchi as well. Mm-hmm. Basically, the two most important co-stars he has in this movie.
Yeah.
I think he's really, really quite good with them. And it's one of those performances where Connery's an Oscar-winning, Academy Award-winning actor, and it wasn't even for a Bond movie. So obviously he's fantastic. He's a legend. But there these little moments you referenced when he figures out that there might be something amiss with the Red Grant, and it's when they're ordering their food. This is also good editing, to be fair, but there's a wide shot when Red Grant orders the red wine, and Connery just, I mean, this is an audio episode, but Connery just raises his eyes a little bit and looks across mm-hmm. the table at Red Grant. It's just those little...
The look of disdain moments. That he has for him, and it's like that's... It's not a verbal cue, and it's not so much of a fit. It's just his eyes, and mm-hmm. it's Fleming.
It's yeah, just, it's well, a Fleming and moment. Connery.
And Connery. But Connery, I think Connery embodies Fleming probably the best because, I mean, Live and Let Die, the movie, is faithful enough to the book. There's some liberties that they take, but it's faithful enough to the book. There's a lot of most of the things that happen in the book happen in the movie. They take a few liberties. But, I mean, besides splitting Mr. Big and Baron Samedi into two separate people, other than that, it's pretty faithful, and Roger Moore plays Bond to a T. I mean, it's I think it's his best performance, and I'm not a big Roger fan. I think Live and Let Die is the best Roger movie for me. But it's not the same. He doesn't play it the same as he doesn't play it to Fleming as Connery played it to Fleming. Like there's the Fleming influences. I think it might be because Fleming was on set during Dr. No, and that kind of really influenced the way he played it, because he was able to relate to the guy who wrote it because he was right there.
That's actually a very astute point you just made there. I think Fleming's presence on the first three, even though he unfortunately never got to see the finished product of Goldfinger, but his visits on set may very well have informed Connery a little bit. And the level of impressiveness each personality had on the other went both ways. Because as we recall in the Only Live Twice book obituary, you know, suddenly Bond's parents are, I think his father is Scottish.
Yeah.
So that was Fleming's deference to Connery's mesmerizing performance. I mean, I can't get angry at anyone who picks any of the James Bond. I can't even get angry at anyone who picks, you know, George Lazenby. I think Darlington, I can't get enough of George Lazenby.
God,
the actor.
Yeah.
The actor. Just to be clear. But I mean, Connery, to me, this is at the top. This is just that sweet spot. I would maybe flip them. Goldfinger is my number two, and From Russia With Love is my number one. It's just that right sweet spot. It's just before we get a little bit too silly. Not that I'm trying to be smirch classic like Goldfinger, but it's just before we get a little bit too silly. But there is a sort of air of cool, calm, and collectiveness. He is as cool as a cucumber, really, in this movie. It's pretty freaking awesome.
But I mean, these are the movies where they were the most Fleming, and then we kind of, not that we get away from it, but then we get there's a difference that I think people need to be really aware of. There's a difference between Bond the novel and Bond the film. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of peak Bond the novel, Bond film. Mm-hmm. and you'll take a movie like The Spy Who Loved Me, and that's peak Bond film, but not the novel. Like, it's the, it goes, even GoldenEye is not Fleming, but it's a Bond movie, but it's not Fleming, because I don't, Fleming may have, would have maybe written it like that, but it's not, the elements aren't there in the same sense. Even Diamonds Are Forever, which is lambasted as not the greatest Bond movie with Connery in it, there are Fleming moments to it that are closer to a Fleming movie than to a Bond movie, as the stereotype could be, you know?
Yeah, isn't the scene where he's about to get incinerated at the slumber, what's it called? Isn't
that Slumber Inc.
Slumber, that's in the book.
Yeah, that's in the book. But even the Winton kid, I mean, they're as silly as it might look on film, that's part of the book. I mean, the only difference with the book really is you got more mafia in it. I mean, it's mafia and it's not Spectre. I mean, they embellish it and they create the whole Spectre part of it, and you know, Connery looks a little worse for wear, and there's a lot of Fleming elements to it,
looking a little flaky.
But it gets to like a Bond movie, like it's kind of on the cusp of, you know, what the stereotypical Hollywood Bond movie, Golden Man with the Golden Gun, and some of the Connery, not Connery, the Roger Moore Octopussy, a little more fanciful, a little more silly, and a little more campy, too.
No, for sure, for sure. There was something I wanted to ask you, and we maybe sort of circuitously touched upon this a little bit, but, you know, we talked about how this one is steeped very much in Cold War atmosphere. You know, it's a little bit backloaded with the action, but there is really a spy story. You regaled the listeners for a few moments in how it was inspired by something Fleming's ideas and escapades. So there is some authenticity to the plot. In the context of all of those notions, and where we are today, it was 60th anniversary of this movie. As of this recording, we do not have a 007th actor on record. Do you wish that, every once in a while, they knocked out a From Russia with Love? I'm not saying redo it. I'm not saying remake it, but just something where it's like, go get this little machine and do sneaky Bond stuff. And here are a couple of action beats, because even stuff like, you know, Skyfall, his house is blowing up at the end and people are falling off the buildings in Shanghai and No Time to Die. You know, the island blows up and cars are flipping in Jurassic Park, you know. We haven't had a From Russia with Love in a little while. Do you long for a From Russia with Love?
I do, but at the same time, I think the they're making it essentially harder and harder to do well. I mean, if you look at what Hollywood's able to do in those kinds of stories, the most successful kind of one that would be in that vein is maybe Ocean's 11. That kind of gives it that vibe of a heist or of like a plan, and not necessarily action where you've actually got some spy craft. I think they tried to do that with Red Notice, but Red Notice kind of didn't. I think that's what the idea might have been, but
maybe on paper before the script was finished.
But I mean, if you there's no Bond movie that really kind of pulls that off in the modern era where you have like
maybe Bond Casino Royale would be the closest thing. One to it. Casino
but
Royale,
I mean,
would be the closest.
Casino Royale is really close to Fleming. I mean, they made some major changes, but I mean, it was by that time it was a 60-year-old or a 50-something-year-old's book. So of course they had to make some changes to make it more modern. But I think it gets kind of touchy if you're not doing it as a period piece, because I think people kind of expect that if you're going to do something that audacious, you got to have a lot of action to move the story along. And I would point to the Bourne series as kind of, if you want to give him one singular mission, then you've got to fill it with action, because people are not going to be able to sit there and watch a movie where there's just spycraft stuff going on.
No, that's true. We don't. That's not really what the market demands. I mean, my question pertained more to your emotions and not to your intellect. Although the intellectual answer was well played, to be fair, kudos to you.
But I think that if James Bond was to return and do, you know, they say, okay, Bond's back, but we're doing it as a period piece, and we're going to redo all of the Bond books, but as period pieces from Fleming's era, I'd be all for it, because I think that would be great. But at the same time, yeah, I do long for kind of a From Russia with Love. Would you be able to do it as a movie in this day and age? Or is it more a TV show that you break up into multiple episodes to kind of build the suspense over shorter periods of time?
Stay tuned on Amazon Prime next year.
Can you keep the attention of someone? You can't make this into a 2-hour movie. So it's that's kind of where you get into the trouble of you would have to pep it up with some action. Do I want to see that? Yeah, I want to see the spycraft stuff. I want to see the Fleming-esque stuff. I want to see the functional gadgets and not just the flashy gadgets. I want to see, you know, dead drops, and I want to see everything that happens in From Russia with Love, all the little spycraft stuff. I want to see it. But I necessarily Hollywood's got to back it with lots of action to make it palatable.
Yeah, that's true. No, it's true. I do think, again, the counterpoint about Casino Royale being inspired by a Fleming book aided them greatly. Like that's probably the closest it got. Mm-hmm. The changes birthed more action. I mean, there are no Miami airport planes exploding in the book, but that still works in the movie. That's still a fun sequence in the movie, and we still get the card game. We still get the poisoning. We still get the love sequences. So it's still there.
Airplane scene in the book is a half a page about how he bought a bunch of brothels and they changed the law and he doesn't have brothels anymore. So we changed. We took a half a page of that, his backstory, and said, well, let's make this a whole complicated financial scheme and all that. And
let's blow up an embassy and blow up an airport. And there you go.
Things that they added that they took half a page of Fleming, and it's like a Fleming. Well, he in the book he does this. He just kills a guy. How does he kill him? Well, that's the pre-title sequence. An amazing pre-title sequence.
Oh, that's great. That's great. So, yeah, it's been a little while since we've had a more intimate pre-title sequence, but this is not the. There is a Casino Royale Reloaded. Are there any other points about From Russia with Love that you're salivating at the prospect of broaching?
The only thing that I would like maybe make an absolute point of is that it's the Fleming, the book is based on Fleming's idea that he had named Operation Ruthless. So if you want to go and Google that, it was a plan to down a German plane and steal the decoder right from the plane, but it was deemed to, or no, sorry, a submarine or a boat.
plane, submarine, boat, one of those engines that
a vehicle.
Something that gets you from point A to point B.
But the point was, is the Allies absolutely wanted to get their hands on it. And I mean, even Fleming participated in two different missions where they stole code books to be able to use them after they actually did get their hands on an Enigma. So, I mean, it's the idea of the Enigma is the Lecter in the books. It's the same thing. It's this, it's the same parallel as when they wrote Animal Farm to replace, you know, the explanation for the Bolshevik Revolution. It's replaced one thing that they couldn't write about with another to explain it. And it's the same thing. These plans existed. This is real spycraft. This is the best you could get out of a Bond movie. And even Goldfinger is based on another idea that happened during World War II that's loosely based on an actual plan that actually did happen in part, but the whole basis of this movie and this book is based on the one idea that they had to get this to advance the war, and they wrote a whole book around, you know, actual things that actually happened, you know?
Well, let me ask you this. I don't want to sidetrack us too much, and we have been recording for a little bit, but since From Russia with Love is so steeped in Fleming, and we agree that it's one of the filmic translations that adheres to Fleming as closely as it can, and you just elaborated on a couple of ideas and adventures that Fleming went on that made it into movies, because you've done more Fleming studies than myself. I know his novels, I know Thrilling Cities, and I'm embarrassed to say, even though I have a trio of Fleming books, I haven't read them, as you know, biographies and Goldeneye and this and that. I haven't read them. You have read a lot. Have you come across anything in those books, a mission, an idea, whether it was used in World War II, whether it was rejected, but just something where you read that and said, hey, they haven't used that in a Bond movie. That would be pretty cool.
Well, the whole idea of mincemeat, we mentioned it before. That's, I mean, Fleming wrote that on a napkin And that became a whole mission that they actually pulled off. By the way, if you want to learn more about it, get the book. Don't watch the Netflix movie. I know it won a lot of awards, but they embellished it with all kinds of stuff that didn't need to be there. And they made it longer than it needed to be. Mm-hmm. And they kind of, they romanticized parts of it that's not the whole basis of it was drop a body with information for mm-hmm. the enemy to find. Now, it would be hard to make that into a Bond movie now, just because the ideas of
you would just no well, enemy or the enemy is so discreet and
you would have to like, it would have to be a national kind of threat. They would have more or almost you would have to be, you know, it would be the idea of dropping a body, you know, on the bad guy's lawn with information for him to find out, or, you know, purposely misleading someone. So you would have to, it could work, but I think one of those kind of like Fleming-esque ideas that kind of didn't make it, one of them would be that I'm trying to think, there was maybe another operation that he tried to pull off, you know, other stuff that Fleming did during the war that they haven't used in books as of yet, would really be like, you know, the assault unit 30 that he was he directed. Bond, you know, could you put him in a situation where he's directing a militia operation or a joint operation in a foreign country? You could put it in the context of there's a war going on and he's called back to active service, or it's a flashback or something like that. Or if they're reintroducing the series and they want to go into the kind of like that's how he gets recruited into MI6.
Or there's, even, you know, what we haven't had in a long time is a climax with two little armies. We haven't had that in a while.
You would have to have kind of like a civil war kind of, you know, you would probably have to go back to like the old James, even like, I want to say Fleming, but I don't think he really ever did that with fictitious nations, but they've done it before with the films where, you know, the License to Kill is an example, what's the other one with the,
Saint-Monique.
Yeah, exactly. Like you create a fictional country and they're in conflict with someone else. And there's what was the Solo was the Bond book that came out not too long ago.
Yes.
That was the same kind of thing where you could militarize it like that and have that. Would it be super popular? I don't know how much war movies are really as popular as they were maybe in the 90s, early 2000s, but you could go in that direction. I think those are the really kind of only Fleming elements and stories that kind of happened during his time during World War II that haven't kind of made it into the Bond books or the films.
Interesting. Oh, good stuff, man. Good stuff. Anything else you wanted to broach?
I think I'm good. I think that's really, that takes care of all my notes.
I just got, hold on. Can you hold on 2 seconds, Emery?
Yeah.
I just got an email in my personal mailbox. It's a little bit late in the day for that. Let's see.
It's got to be spam.
No. I don't. No? How did this sucker make so that it's not spam? It's from M. White.
Oh,
and
God.
It's all in caps. It's underlined and it's bold in red, and it's. Screams, it begs to know an essential bit of information. That is, do you have people everywhere?
Everywhere. We do have people everywhere. We're currently on, well, Instagram, of course, at the James Bond Complex, and Facebook. Our podcast is hosted on Anchor, obviously, and you can listen to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, some of my favorites.
That's
There's Google a website, Podcasts. Google Podcasts,
YouTube.
Yeah, we've got the YouTube going too. you'll see that in the next. I think this comes out the week after. You just saw a YouTube video that's brand new.
Oh, yes,
in Edgar and Jason. So you can, if you're on any of those podcasting platforms, listening to us. Have you written a review? Have you given us the 5-star Golden Gun review?
And why not? If you haven't, we would appreciate an explanation, please. I'm impatient to know why.
Written, that needs to be a formal essay. I need 500 words on my desk by now. So we could be found there. I'm on Instagram as well, 77_intrepid.
I don't share any of that because I don't post anything Bond related. Since we have this podcast, why would I do it on my personal accounts?
Exactly. And so that's it. Of course, James Bond will return, so will the James Bond complex.
Et ciao, merci, sur ce, toujours un plaisir, et à la prochaine. Ciao, bye-bye. Baby. Hasta la próxima. Hasta la próxima. ASMR, James Bond style.